Hi, I'm Michael Miller, and this is Speaking of Meditation, real-life stories of people who meditate, why they do it, and how it's changed their lives. If you've tried meditation and struggled, or you're practicing and need more inspiration, I hope these conversations will encourage and motivate you. Today's guest, Lily Spicer. This conversation with Lily was really interesting for me. Lily is one of the younger people we have taught, and she's been so committed to her practice over a long period. I think you'll find her story fascinating, how meditation saw her through her teens, helped her thrive in school, and how her friends are finally coming around to meditation as well. So, speaking of meditation, here's Lily. Enjoy. Hi, Lily.
Hi, Michael.
I'm really glad we're talking because I realize you have been meditating for a very long time, and we've spent a fair amount of time together around different events and in India, and yet I'm not sure that we've ever sat down and really talked just one-on-one in detail. So I'm as interested as I hope other people are going to be.
Great. No, it's always nice to have an excuse to catch up with you, Michael. So I'm really excited.
So Lily, tell me, before we get into meditation, tell me a little bit about your family and growing up and school. Just give me a little background.
Sure. So I had an extraordinarily happy childhood, to be honest. I grew up in London with my mom, my dad, and my little sister. My mom was a meditator, is a meditator, but I'm sure we'll talk about that later. And yeah, I went to school in London and then went off to university and graduated from university a couple of years ago. And now I'm kind of, in my early 20s, the beginning of my career, and I work in the arts. Yeah, it's been a good life so far.
I have this image that your life is a little bit like a Richard Curtis film. You know, as an American, that was
my whole image
of London. No, come on. Don't you ride your bike to work across Hyde Park?
I do.
Your name's Lily.
I think
both where you went to secondary school and where you went to university would fit into a Richard Curtis film beautifully.
No, now that you say that, you're totally right. It's been, I guess, a charmed life is maybe how I would describe it. Yeah, I've been very lucky.
That's great. And tell me what your work is now.
So I now work in a press office for a big arts charity, big arts organization, which kind of has stemmed from what I studied at university. I read history of art. And yeah, so I'm like 18 months into my first ever proper job. But before that, I did a bunch of different jobs while I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. So I've kind of done a lot of different varied things before kind of landing on my path now. And I'm still figuring out what my path is going to be.
And does it feel like arts is where you want to be or where you will be for a while?
No, not necessarily, actually. It just feels perfect for this moment.
Well, make sure your employer doesn't hear this.
I hope not.
When you were, because you went to boarding school, yes?
Yes.
When you think back to that, would your friends have imagined you, or did you imagine you in the place where you are now? Do people go, oh, right, that makes sense that Lily's doing that? Or do you think this is so far off the path I ever expected or anyone else did?
That's a really good question. I don't think people would be hugely surprised, to be honest, maybe because I've always, a lot of my good friends from kind of school and university have gone down quite, shall we say, conventional career paths. Mine, well, not wildly unconventional, let's be realistic. It's a bit different. And so I think people always would have probably said I was going to do something along those lines, and definitely something a bit more creative and possibly in the arts, because when I was at school, that was always kind of what I loved doing. I loved doing the drama and the music and all of that kind of stuff. So I would say it would be predictable to an extent.
And it must have been fascinating. As you say, your sort of first real grown-up job in the midst of the pandemic. You had started just before lockdown?
Yeah, I started my job 6 months before lockdown, which was completely invaluable because I actually got to know my colleagues in person a bit, at least, you know, whereas quite a lot of my friends have started jobs literally on Zoom and still haven't met any of their colleagues, which is really, really difficult. So it's been a strange time to be at the beginning of your career, especially as I think when you're just starting out in the workplace, actually physically being in the workplace and picking up on the kind of dynamics of the office is such an integral part of kind of how you learn how to exist in a workplace and how to become part of an organization and kind of integrate yourself into your company or your institution or whatever it is. So it has been strange, and learning how to be emotionally intelligent over Zoom with people a lot older than you and a lot more senior than you has been a challenge.
That's really interesting, the emotional intelligence factor, because I do think those first few jobs we have are so much about learning how to socialize, not in the sense of how to be at a dinner party together, but socializing yourself into an environment with other humans that, as you say, are different, because up to then you have teachers, professors, parents, and then people your age. And then suddenly you are peers or coworkers. You had 6 months of being in person. You're in a world that there can be quite a status difference between someone who's coming in and someone who's been there a long way. It's not like you can come in as a salesperson and be a bit of a hotshot and rocket to the top. There is, in the arts, often you have to put in your time and earn some status. What do you see in your friends or other people in your organization who did join, and how is their emotional intelligence going?
I would say most people are doing remarkably well. And it's always weird when you meet someone for the first time that you've been talking to on Zoom for months and they're like 2 foot taller than you thought they would be. I just think, yeah, it's a real struggle. My boyfriend started his job, I think, a couple of weeks before lockdown. And so really hadn't had the ability to just, you kind of learn the signals that, you know, when your boss comes into the office and they are visibly frazzled or they've just had a fight with their toddler, and you kind of you can pick that up if you're in the same room with them and go, okay, I'm not going to bother that person today, or I'm not going to ask them any stupid questions. Whereas if they're just appearing on a Zoom screen, it's so much harder to kind of gauge those subtle signals. So I'm just so glad I didn't have to start something in the midst of lockdown.
I think coming out of lockdown is going to be equally discombobulating for people.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel quite comfortable in the lockdown sort of format of life. I feel slightly cocooned. I think people call it lock home syndrome, the sense of having kind of finally got the hang of being at home and working from home and that whole setup. And now the idea of going back into the office every day feels like a bit of a wrench. Not to mention, I don't think I'd have the stamina for it. Like sometimes I have to go in, you know, for a day or half a day now, and it is exhausting. And I think, I can't believe we used to do this every day, like rush around, you know, go into work, then go straight on to do something in the evening and meet friends and come back and then do it all again the next day. It's a very different pace of life, isn't it?
Well, and maybe you would go and do a workout in the morning and then go to a coffee shop and call a friend while you're there and then go to the office and run out at lunchtime to see someone and then back.
Yes.
And then go out in the evening.
Michael, I used to go to a yoga class that began at 7 a.m. before work. And the idea of that now is like totally unfathomable to me. I can't believe I used to be that efficient.
I think it's going to come back fast.
I hope so.
All right, let's talk about meditation. You mentioned before your mom was a meditator and she was a big influence on you learning. So talk to me about what that was like as a child, because, you know, I have a 7-year-old, and that is just part of her life because both Jillian and I are teachers and that's such a priority. My sense is that with your mom, meditation was a priority and you were witnessing that. What was that like, and how did it inspire you or not inspire you to learn?
It's exactly like you say, you know, with Loie growing up with you guys. I think for me, it was around at home My mum was meditating. My dad learned to meditate a few years after her. And so I just thought it was the most normal thing in the world. I kind of maybe assumed when I was younger that it was something maybe all grown-ups did. But I so vividly remember, in terms of the impact that it had on me, my mum was a very busy working mum. She worked incredibly hard, and she worked in the travel business. So she was also traveling a lot. And she would come in the evenings or come back from a trip and walk through the door, often still on a business call, and would be quite frantic, quite frenetic, maybe exhausted. And she would say, hi, 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 hello, and make a beeline for the sofa and sit down and do what she called her 20 minutes. And she would emerge after these 20 minutes. And we knew it was like a good time to just like leave her alone and not bother her. And after the 20 minutes, she would emerge like a different person. I mean, you know, she was still our mum, but she was just refreshed and reinvigorated and able to totally put her attention on us, her kids. And it was then about, okay, what's your homework? What are we having for dinner? What are we going to watch on TV tonight? And work was kind of left to one side. It was like this kind of transitionary phase she was able to just enter into and then like emerge. And I just thought that was like magical. I thought it was like a magic power. And so when I was kind of old enough, like, well, I was 12 when I learned to meditate. And that was the kind of time when, you know, I was doing my first kind of big set of exams, which aren't important in the grand scheme of things. But when you're 12, my God, they feel very important. And I was starting to feel like I knew what stress felt like. And so I thought maybe I should, if it works for mum, maybe it will work for me. And that's why I said to her, you know, can I learn? And luckily she said yes.
I bet she was thrilled. I think so many parents hope that their children will do it. And we always tell parents, I mean, first, sometimes a parent will come to us and say, you know, my 8-year-old or 10-year-old or 12-year-old is so stressed. Can you teach them to meditate? And first we say, not until you're meditating.
Yes.
You know, it's true. Because often the parent learns, reduces their own stress levels. And that has such an impact on the child that they don't even then need to take that next step, at least for a while. But then, like what happened with you, they witness their mom or their dad meditating, and it's normal, although it's not normal. Not everyone is doing it. It's quite unusual. But it becomes normalized within the family, and they see the benefit. Draw me the picture of you learning. So you're 12.
So I'm 12.
And you go, like, tell me everything you remember about that moment. And, you know, like, describe what you remember seeing and hearing and really the details of that experience, the best you can remember.
Of course, yeah. So this is back in the day when you and Gillian used to teach in your flat. Yes. So I remember coming to your flat, and I must have been, you know, 20 years younger than the second youngest person on the course. Like, because, I mean, I know now you maybe do like junior courses or courses for kids. But, you know, back then it was me. My little sister came as well. She was 10 at the time. And we did the 4-day introductory course, same as the grown-ups. But Gillian, so it was Gillian that taught me. Gillian assigned me as kind of junior mantra, which is a kind of simplified version of the mantra that I went on to have as an adult. And I remember her asking us to draw a picture after our first meditation, or maybe our first couple of days of meditating, of what it felt like to be a meditator, like an illustration. And I remember, I don't know, if maybe Gillian still has it somewhere. I remember drawing myself sitting down with my eyes closed, and then getting a big crayon out and drawing like chaos, like, you know, like a Jackson Pollock painting, like all around the side. But then this little sort of, I don't know, like a kind of halo around me, which was like the stillness. That was like the symbol of the calm and the sort of peace that I felt when I was meditating. So that I remember doing. And I just remember walking out of your flat after my very first meditation and seeing the world as if in high definition, which was totally crazy for me. It was like, you know, the leaves on the trees, the pavement, everything was crystal clear, as if, you know, as if I had really needed a you know, prescription for my reading glasses and I'd suddenly put them on for the first time. That's kind of what it felt like. And I've since kind of heard, you know, other friends that have learned to meditate in those first few days, that kind of, that similar thing of, wow, seeing the world in high definition, obviously that fades a little bit over time. And or maybe it's, you know, it normalizes. And so it doesn't feel so much of a shock. That was my kind of, the walking out of the room is the thing I remember the most actually from that first session.
I love that. And I love the normalization. You know, the first time you watch high definition television, it almost looks like something's wrong. It's so big and bright and sharp. And then you watch one movie and you're adjusted to it and it becomes your expectation. And I do hear what you're saying from a lot of meditators, that I had one guy say it was his taste. He had a strawberry the night that he learned, and he said it was just the greatest strawberry of my life. And it was, I think, a good farmer's market strawberry. It wasn't that good. It was that he was tasting in a different way.
Yeah.
As you say, seeing with a different kind of clarity.
Mm. Yeah. The senses sharpening is a really interesting one. And it's something I think all meditators, it seems to affect them slightly differently. But I definitely noticed, especially after years and years of meditating, that my senses have become sharper. And obviously it's now normal to me, but then I'll realize in contrast to other people, like I'm really sensitive to loud noise, you know, extremely loud noise in a way that other people aren't. Like at university, having to be on dance floors and nightclubs. And I would say to my friends, like, oh my God, isn't it so loud in here? And they'd be like, no, what are you talking about? Yeah. So that's the one downside of being a meditator is that being in nightclubs is really challenging.
I'm not sure that that's a downside, except as you say, you know, when you're at uni and you have to be in nightclubs.
Yeah, exactly.
There's certain requirements.
I'm past that phase now, and actually lockdown has provided a perfect excuse to stay away from nightclubs. So.
Yes, yes. So, you know, there you were, you're 12, going into those early exams. How then, you know, if that was part of the reason when you looked at your mom's calm and her ability to let go of work and you were feeling the first nigglings of stress, do you feel, I mean, can you remember there being a difference, or maybe as that other thing that you said about in contrast to others, were you noticing a difference?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like meditation had given me any superpowers in terms of academic ability or stamina. I think it was just, it gave me the ability to not be ever incapacitated by stress. The stress never became stifling or overwhelming. And so, you know, I absolutely still felt the pressure and I felt the stress and I felt, you know, the whole way through my kind of academic life, right up until I was doing my finals at university, like I absolutely felt pressure, and I also piled a lot of pressure on myself, but it never incapacitated me, and it just allowed me to just try and fulfill my best potential, which, you know, as you know, you can only really do when you are feeling clear-headed and relatively calm. That's really what I felt like was the greatest gift, was being able to sit down at the beginning of an exam and think, okay, this is important, but it's not life or death. And to keep it in perspective, and actually when you come to it with that attitude, you're able to perform so much better than if you're, you know, every minute going, oh my God, if I don't get this, I'm not going to get my GCSEs and I'm not going to get it to university, and, you know, spinning this whole narrative. So yeah, the ability to remain incapacitated by stress and also to just remain that sense of perspective about, you know, the reality of the situation. It's very easy, I think, particularly in the, you know, today's education system, and I think it's probably got even worse since I did exams a few years ago. You know, there is so much pressure piled onto young people to, you know, achieve better and, you know, push themselves to their absolute, you know, maximum potential, that it's incredibly easy to become, you know, totally overwhelmed. And I've seen this, so many of my contemporaries and peers had, you know, close to breakdowns around exams, which when you actually consider what an exam is, it's, you know, it shouldn't be something that causes you to completely lose all sight of yourself and reality. I only wish more children had access to that, you know, that inner state of that calm and peace in order to be able to navigate the education system and the exam system, because it's such a powerful tool.
I think on top of that, now there's the social pressures that there have always been, but then with social media as another aspect of that. And if you look at the figures of depression and anxiety and, you know, real pressure that is especially hitting young women, the levels of self-harm and, you know, just eating disorders, really, really serious things, it does seem like meditation could make such a difference. And it is still unusual. How, you know, there you are at boarding school, surrounded by other people who are not doing this. How in the world did you meditate? One of the things we tell parents is, look, don't pressurize your child to meditate. Like, they will learn and they'll do it as they do it. And just, you know, if you tell them to do it, they'll rebel and they'll never come back to it. But you somehow kept doing it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I would say on that point about, you know, the best way to persuade your child to learn to meditate is just by example, rather than saying, I really think you should do this thing. It's like, I really think you should do your homework. I really think you should brush your teeth. Like, you will resist if you're nagged about it. And I see the same with even my friends now who I know would really benefit from meditation. But I've learned that actually the best way to persuade them is actually just to keep my mouth shut and try and just demonstrate what it feels like to be calm. Going to boarding school as a meditator, like I said before, when I had grown up, I thought it was pretty normal. You know, my mum had friends who meditated. Being part of a kind of meditation community in London and growing to group meditations, I thought, you know, this is quite a popular thing. And not only did I go to boarding school, I went to a very traditional boarding school that was a long way outside of London. Not only had meditation not gone mainstream yet, it was kind of, I mean, my friends used to tease me that I was doing like voodoo magic, which is, in hindsight, completely ridiculous, as I was literally sitting with my eyes closed. But it was really challenging, and it was kind of definitely the point in my life where I've probably come closest to falling off the bandwagon for periods of time with my meditation, because, you know, I didn't have my own room for 5 years and I was sharing with, you know, up to like 6 other girls. Every time you sat down to close your eyes, it was almost guaranteed that you'd be interrupted. Yeah, there was people were pretty, you know, after a while, they got used to the fact that, you know, Lily meditates and I'm sure it's making her happy, whatever. But I was kind of gently teased for it, and people would say, oh, you know, you're so zen, or you think your body's a temple, and just generally quite dismissive. There wasn't a lot of kind of curiosity around it. Funnily enough, in the years following school, quite a lot of those same kids have been in touch with me on Facebook or LinkedIn or whatever, going, so that thing you used to do with your eyes closed, how can I learn to do that?
Well, there's quite a crowd.
I heard this meditation thing is kind of taking off.
There's quite a crowd of your friends who have learned now.
Yeah, which is really wonderful. And, you know, some of those were the ones who were, you know, back in the day, quite dismissive or quite suspicious, really, of what it was. And it's interesting because it's definitely, there's a correlation between friends that I, you know, spend a lot of time with and who then subsequently want to learn to meditate. So friends that I've been on, you know, trips with or gone traveling with, or, you know, lived, like the girl who I lived in the room next to at uni, actually, if they're kind of in proximity to the meditation for a certain period of time, that's when the kind of the penny drops, I think, and people start to ask more questions. And once they've asked a certain number of questions, I feel like I can gently say, oh, well, you know, I can send you the link if you want. They do these introductory free talks you can go along to.
It's that subtle way of getting in. And I'm sure you've heard me say this at group meditations, but I always try to say it on the course. You know, there are people in your life who will not be supportive of you and your practice. And those people don't need to know that you're meditating. You know, don't offer pearls before swine. Because you're doing something that is going to change your life, and don't offer it up to someone who's going to trivialize that. And to be the connection for someone, to be the human that leads someone else to meditation, because it's always through another person that you witness someone meditating or you hear about some celebrity who's meditating. And, you know, don't push it, don't proselytize, but if you can slip a few things in there, it's so, so good. And I tried to strike the right balance because in describing that, because the way that you've done it has sent people along. You don't want it to be totally private and not reveal it to anyone. And you want to have a little bit of care around that important practice for yourself at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's such a gratifying thing, like you say, when you lead other people to it and you see that the benefits they reap from it and how it can change their lives. And then down the line, they introduce their friends and their family. And suddenly I'll go along to a group meditation and I'll see like my friend's dad or, you know, my friend's friend. And there's this whole growing, you know, network and of meditators. And I can trace it back to myself. And that is just an amazing feeling. You really feel like you've had a positive impact on people's lives, and the domino effect will keep on rippling. Yeah, I guess that's how your whole meditation community has kind of built very organically, which is a wonderful thing.
I'm sure that if we track the branch of the tree, that, you know, I can think who introduced your mom to us. Yeah. And you know, there's that person and then her and then you and then that person and then that person, that person's younger brother and actually their uncle is already meditating and can join in, and all of it comes together in an amazing, amazing way. What are you seeing in your friends who are meditating? What difference do you notice other than, yay, I've got a friend who's meditating?
Quite a wide spectrum of my friends have started meditating now, actually. So everyone from the people who you might perhaps expect to, in the sense that, you know, they're interested in maybe well-being or they're into yoga or, you know, those kinds of people. And then on the other end of the spectrum, a couple of pretty high octane individuals who have incredibly intense jobs or wouldn't go near a green smoothie if they could help it. So it's been fascinating actually to witness how different people have responded to it. And it's, I can definitely say that it's helped all of them, but in different ways, because, you know, people come to meditation and they need meditation for very different reasons, right? Like some people, it's just, it gives them, like, I'm thinking of like my boyfriend, Rupert. When he learned to meditate, he's like a naturally incredibly calm person. He didn't need, you know, stress alleviation really, but he really needed something that would kind of supercharge his rest. Like he would just get really, really tired. And since he learned to meditate, he's just had abundantly more energy. Whereas other of my friends were kind of, you know, close to burnout with stress, and they needed meditation to kind of dial down the anxiety and come back into equilibrium. So yeah, it's been fascinating. And I think the meditators now are all, how best to put this? They have a, like I was talking about the sense of perspective earlier, I feel like they're able to sort of zoom out to the kind of macro and see things in the longer term, right? Rather than just thinking, how am I going to get through today? How am I going to, you know, they're able to kind of see the bigger picture and maybe sweat the small stuff a little bit less, if that makes sense.
It so does.
Yeah, exactly.
And what are you finding in yourself now, having meditated for more than 10 years now?
Yeah, it's about 12 years now. The meditation has definitely kind of grown as I've grown, if that makes sense. And not only because I had my adult mantra, and then I've done an advanced technique, and I've been on retreat. So there's a kind of natural evolution in that sense. But it also kind of, it feels like the practice has adapted to my life and what I've needed it to, how I've needed it to serve me at different points. I think it has, as I've been a meditator for longer and longer, I think the kind of curiosity around, you know, the roots of the Vedic meditation tradition and wanting to learn more about the Vedas and Ayurveda and all of the kind of the more holistic stuff around it. So meditation has come to kind of permeate more areas of my life outside of those 20-minute slots twice a day. And that has been really wonderful. And the other thing I would say is that meeting other meditators over the years on retreats, at group meditations, at events, has been possibly one of my favorite benefits of meditation, up there with better sleep and reduced anxiety, because it's just been so refreshing to meet people that you have this wonderful thing in common with, you know, because I have meditation friends who are, you know, from a different generation to me, a different background to me, they're from a different part of the world. And yet when you come together in a group, there's this instant sense of trust and intimacy that is a result of having the shared experience that you meditate twice a day. For me, that's just been wonderful. My meditation friends are some of my favorite friends.
That is great. So what would you say to people to get more friends? What's your pitch to people when, if you were to get up in front of a group and say, you should meditate because?
Well, I would tailor it to the group, depending on...
Well, that's your skilled communications background.
Exactly. If I was, you know, there are some people that will respond really well if you say, you should meditate because it will make you look younger. And there are other people that will, I mean, a lot of my, you know, my sort of young, ambitious friends, if you say to them, meditation will make you more productive and able to function on less sleep, they'll go, oh, that sounds fantastic. I'll do that tomorrow. I've definitely become quite astute at tailoring my pitch to different types of people. But yeah, if it was a room full of all different types of people, I would just say this practice is like having an opportunity twice a day to plug your brain into charge. It's like just 20 minutes of pure rest and relief from the relentless stimulation of every day, and you will emerge feeling better. You will emerge feeling refreshed, and you will be able to get more out of life. And I don't think anyone would say no to that, would they?
I don't think so. Lily, that is fantastic. And this has been so nice to speak together. I feel like I've caught up with you and your meditation in a way that I didn't even expect. And it's so inspiring, I think, for people, because almost everyone, when they learn to meditate, says, oh, I wish I had learned 5 years ago before I turned 50, or 10 years ago before I got divorced, or 20 years ago before I took that first job. And, you know, in a certain way, you learned when people wish they had learned.
Yeah.
You learning when you did has impacted you and your family and your friends, and you are such an example of the spreading power of meditation and fitting it into life. You know, you joke that you're different than other people, but actually you'd fit just fine into a Richard Curtis movie. And and for goodness sake, your boyfriend's name is Rupert. That would be the name of the boyfriend in the movie.
You're so right, Michael. God.
Well, it's going to be a happy ending, no doubt.
Oh, I hope so. It still feels like the beginning of the movie, to be honest.
It is. It's the very beginning. All right, Lily. Well, really great speaking.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
Have a great meditation this afternoon.
I certainly will. Thank you so much. Take care.
Bye. Speaking of Meditation is written and produced by me, Michael Miller, with direction from Jillian Lavender and assistance by Emma Ray. With original music by Rich Jacques. That's RichJacques.com. And graphics by LNL.com. Speaking of meditation, what are you noticing? Who is benefiting? How are you staying inspired? And when are you next closing your eyes? Bye for now.